You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Very importantly, what we want, we have to have a wall. If the wall is going to be obstructed when we need the funds at a little bit later date, if I don't get the wall, then we will become the obstruction.
US President Donald Trump saying some words about his wall that he's definitely going to build and which will certainly not be, 4 years from now, a heap of bricks piled forlornly next to a cactus. But why is he suddenly getting along so well with the Democratic Party? My guests James Rogers and Florence Biederman will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Russia says there's no reason to be alarmed by its massive military exercises. Does this mean that we should be alarmed by Russia's massive military exercises? Kurdistan's accelerating drive for independence and the first inklings of a post-UK EU. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Florence Biederman, London Bureau Chief of Agence France-Presse, and James Rogers, Head of International Journalism Studies at City University London. Welcome both. First of all, a joke popular in the last days of Russia's monarchy held that the two most powerful men in the country were Nicholas II and whoever had most recently spoken to him. It is a gag that may shortly acquire renewed currency in Washington, D.C., where U.S. President Donald Trump, not hitherto known as a friend of the Democratic Party or of immigrants, appears to be on the verge of doing a deal with the Democratic Party to protect immigrants, specifically the so-called Dreamers, those immigrants born in the US to parents who arrived there illegally. Florence, first of all, this follows his budget deal with the Democrats of last week, which did arch a few Republican eyebrows in particular. What appears to be going on here?
Supposed to be going on is the art to make a deal, as he said it himself. It appears that there are some limits to his power, and he's learning some pragmatism if he wants to push through what he wants to achieve. And he cannot do that without a bit of support of the Democrats. So in the end, it's rather good news to learn that the American president is restricted by the institution of his country.
It's not news, James, that Donald Trump is a man of, put it charitably, flexible opinions. As recently as 2015, when he was running for the nomination, he said of the Dreamers flatly that they have to go. Whereas today he's tweeting the rhetorical question, does anybody really want to throw out good, educated and accomplished young people who have jobs, some serving in the military? This time a month ago, he was exactly that person. What has changed? Has James Kelly just taken his phone off him?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, if you think about that, as you say, that is the line which you just quoted is precisely the sort of thing which one of his opponents might have thrown at him during the election campaign. And now he's apparently very happily signing up to these ideas himself. There is possibly, as you say, talk about the new management amongst his new chief of staff and the rest of his team is trying to instill some discipline in him. But I think also as a pattern which we can see right throughout the Trump presidency so far is its campaign rhetoric colliding with reality. This happens to every single politician who's elected. But if your campaign rhetoric is so overblown, as Mr. Trump's was in many cases, then the collision with reality is all the more apparent once it happens.
I'll ask the evergreen question, Florence, which you can always apply to Trump, and then we can discuss the details of this. But do you discern here an actual thought-through strategy on his part, or is he just desperately winging it?
Well, strategy, I don't know. It's difficult, a question difficult to answer. I think he's just trying to make the best of the situation. He's contradicting himself. The situation is a bit difficult for him. He's blocked by the Democrats in Congress. So I would say it appears to be a day-to-day strategy, I would say.
What do you think, James? Is he just making this up as he goes along?
I think to a large extent he probably is. I mean, he's trying to deal with it on a day-to-day. I mean, we heard in that clip which you played at the top of the programme about him still saying, you know, this wall is going to be built at a little later date. It is still going to happen. So that, in a way, was a sort of, might well have been part of an immigration strategy. So in a way, he's clinging to it. He's saying, look, there are elements of this which I'm determined to come to pass, but he's not saying when that's going to happen. It does, and particularly with the contradictions, I think it's very difficult to see that in any other terms than some form of inconsistency. It's difficult to discern any strategic policy in there.
I mean, Florence, you alluded earlier to the title of his book, which bits of which he may even have read, though I suspect he didn't write, The Art of the Deal. Is it possible, and this is trying to be optimistic, that there is a way through here in which some legislation is passed to protect the Dreamers, and there is a measure of tightening of border security? And you can make a perfectly reasonable, respectable argument in favour of border security. Is it possible that there is a grand bargain to be done here?
Yeah, that's what he's trying to achieve. And by the way, I think there are questions of what you mean with the word wall, you know. Trump saying, I'm going to build a wall. First of all, that it exists already, more or less. There are some barriers. And now, if the suggestion is to tighten the border control, to have drones, to have all this electronic and technology which you can use, then, yes, I mean, what is a wall? You can build a kind of a wall, an invisible wall, but still it would be a wall.
A wall akin to the Emperor's new clothes.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add as well that we were talking about whether one can discern a strategy here. There is one thing which Mr. Trump does seem so far to have been able to rely on. Even if his approval ratings have fallen in the time that he's been in office, he has still got a very solid core constituency who seem pretty much willing to forgive him these apparent contradictions.
Well, on that core constituency, and I know I've seen the same polls you have, the ones that suggest 61% of Trump voters, I think it's about 61%, can literally think of nothing he could do that would cause them to change their minds. But on this, we have seen professional shrieking harpy Ann Coulter tweet who doesn't now want him impeached, and Breitbart has described it as a full-fledged cave. Is it possible that this, perhaps ironically, is the thing that causes his base to desert him?
Possibly, we'll see. I mean, obviously Breitbart is a slightly more complicated question with the gentleman closely associated with it, talking about getting his hands back on his weapons and everything like that. So it's it will be interesting to see, and often it may well be that somebody who's been elected on this sort of platform will suffer a loss of popularity because they give in on a plank of it rather than what they do to offend their natural opponents. But I think still, you know, if he's talking about still continuing to plan to build the wall, there is something in there for some of his supporters who want to hear that to hear.
Again, Florence, I may be reading more into this than Donald Trump is, but one thing that has characterised his career and his life is a fairly well-tuned and ruthless instinct towards self-preservation above all else. Is he perhaps calculating that at some point he might need Democratic votes to avoid impeachment?
Maybe. That could be a calculation. In any case, I think if he still clings to the idea of a wall, and if he explained to his basis that he cannot achieve it because of the Democrats, then again, he will stand his ground. I mean, the ground that will allow him to survive, as you say.
Because he doesn't really care about getting things done, does he? What he cares about is not getting blamed when they don't get done.
Obviously.
We will move along slightly now towards Eastern Europe's border with Russia, on the other side of which anything up to 100,000 troops are on the move. There is, in theory, no need for listeners in the vicinity to consider stocking their basements with tinned goods. This is a scheduled exercise by Russia's military called Zapad, which will last until September 20th. It will take place not merely in Russia, but in Belarus and in the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad. Russian officials have been emphatic that this is not a preparation for a sneak attack on Lithuania, Poland, or Ukraine, but then they would. James, I mean, all military exercises are practicing for something, and as Russia has made the point, all militaries practice and they're perfectly entitled to do that. But I mean, this kind of is practicing for a sneak attack on Lithuania, Poland or Ukraine, isn't it?
Yes, and the name, as you've probably seen in various media reports, means West in Russian. Zapad means West. So, I mean, this
people say they have no sense of humour.
Yes, indeed. And I think what people are looking at when they're trying to assess what the significance of this may be is that previous military exercises within recent years have led to proper military interventions, for example, in Georgia in 2008, and then subsequently in Ukraine, which, of course, led to the taking of Crimea, the annexing of Crimea. How much we should estimate this? I mean, I do remember at the time I was a correspondent in Moscow at the time of the 2008 war with Georgia, and very few people actually predicted that. There was a great deal of tension building around the separatist territories, which Russia subsequently sent troops into and took over control of. But very few people predicted that it would actually end in an armed conflict as it did. I think on this occasion, I mean, I think on that occasion, Russia had actually very calculated very cleverly how its opponent, its enemy, was likely to respond. And I think in this case, this is likely, unlikely to lead to the sort of, attempt to annex part of a NATO member's territory, which would be a significant raising of the stakes. There is other suggestions, though, given that this is taking place in the territory partly of Belarus, that some Russian troops will remain there in some capacity or other. Russia and Belarus, though, have generally very friendly relations, and that would not have the same significance as Russia trying to take a slice of Ukraine, for example.
Florence, Moscow is claiming that 12,700 troops are taking part in this. NATO claims the number is closer to 100,000. Which of those seems more plausible?
Oh, well, I would rather tend to believe what NATO says. And yes, it may be also that more troops are deployed and some of them are going to stay, some capacity are going to stay in the country where the exercises are taking place. And I think their aim is clearly, very clearly, again, to reaffirm that they don't want any extension of NATO towards their border.
Well, I mean, there's not really, apart from Ukraine, much further NATO could go towards their border. Or is that the point they're trying to make?
Yes, well, I mean, Belarus, of course, it's not a possibility now, but suppose there is another regime, suppose things can happen that makes
sure
some countries which are pro-Russia now go further away from Russia.
James, as you pointed out, you operated from Moscow for some time. Does, and this is something that occurs to me, that you get a... What the West sees when it looks as east at Eastern Europe is something very, very different to what Russia sees when it looks at exactly the same stretch of geography. Does the West fail to understand how that part of the world looks to Russia?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a definite gap in understanding in that sense. I mean, I think where people in the West tended to see NATO's westward expansion after the end of the Cold War as something benign and a part of, joining international organisations which embrace democracy. Russia, I mean, one can discuss about whether this is a correct interpretation or not, but there is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that Russia saw this as an offensive act. And there's also no doubt that Mr. Putin has very successfully used the eastward expansion of NATO to include even former parts of the Soviet Union, like Latvia and Lithuania, has used that to shore up his domestic constituency and to use as a basis for his policy abroad. I mean, there was a very strong sense in Russia when Crimea was annexed, for example. This was saying to the West, look, this is the limits. That post-Cold War period where you could expand eastwards at will is over, and we're stopping it right here.
Florence, one response to Zapad, although obviously everybody involved is claiming it's got nothing to do with Zapad, is that we're seeing Sweden holding its biggest war games for 20 years. It's drilling 19,000 troops, as well as some troops from NATO allies, though Sweden is not a member. Do the Scandinavian countries, especially the non-NATO ones, Sweden and Finland, have any reason to worry about Russia?
Certainly they have. I mean, Finland maybe more, because they have a very cruel and bad experience of the Soviet Union. So, of course, they are worried. They are worried as Latvia, Lithuania, Lithuania are too. I mean, whoever is in the surrounding of Vladimir Putin and of this kind of policy has to be worried.
But, I mean... Do you think, though, that there is anywhere further Putin can realistically go, further over that border than he already has? I mean, Ukraine, Crimea being obviously the most obvious incursions he's made into Europe.
No, I don't think. Again, I think the message is let's stay as we are and don't go further to NATO. Mm. That's what it is. And he will be happy if that happens. And we cannot imagine an act of aggression right now. I mean, there is no objective reason for him to do that anyway.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Florence Biedermann and James Rogers. Coming up next, are the Middle East's borders about to be redrawn?
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's the Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Florence Biedermann and James Rogers. Now, the Kurds of Iraq, Syria and Turkey have often claimed, plausibly, to be the world's largest ethnic nation without a country to call their own. That may be about to change. On September 25th, the Kurds of Iraq will vote in a referendum on independence, which seems likely to return a resounding yes vote. But at what risk? Iraq, from which Kurdistan will presumably be intending to secede, rejects the referendum as unconstitutional. Turkey, especially, is unlikely to be delighted, and the rest of the world doubtless equally unenthralled by the prospect of renewed instability in the Middle East. Florence, first of all, to the referendum, is there any reason at all to have any doubt about the result? It's going to be yes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be yes. I mean, the Kurds in the whole area for decades and decades have been asking for, if not independence, autonomy. That was a constant fight under Saddam Hussein regime. That was also the case in Turkey. So, of course, they will get a yes.
James, leaving aside the potential consequences of Kurdish independence, which we will come to shortly, and it's a possibly idle caveat to impose because the potential consequences are considerable, but is there an argument against an independent Kurdistan? Have they basically, I mean, that they have well and truly earned a nation of their own at this point, haven't they?
Well, I think they would certainly say so, but I think obviously, you know, when we if we do come on to consider the consequences, the arguments against would not necessarily be ones which, you know, benefit the Kurds or otherwise. That their views would not necessarily be taken into consideration in that sense. Obviously, the Iraqi government, like most central governments, would be against losing a large swathe of its territory, particularly in this case with the oil revenues which come from there. And so I think you know, it's difficult to say from the Kurds' point of view. There is no obvious disadvantages, apart from the fact of, you know, the extent to which they would be recognised and therefore would be able to establish a plausible state.
Is there any way, Florence, that this could be done unmessily?
Well, I mean, it would certainly, again, have those consequences that there would be some fighting. There would be an imbalance also in Turkey, because if you start with a Kurdish state in the north of Iraq, then, of course, the Kurds in Turkey, who already are asking for more autonomy, not independence, but autonomy, would follow. And it would be really an important part of a new geography in the country. So the imbalance would be such in the area that it's not only the consequences for Iraq, but it's very much the consequences for Turkey.
James, what do you think? How seriously might Turkey dig in against the prospect of of an independent Kurdistan?
I think extremely seriously. I mean, I think this is, you know, as Florence says, this is something that's been going on for decades, and Turkey has never given any indication that it was that way minded. And of course, you know, there is a history of repression of Kurdish language and culture. There has been armed conflict in that region. So I think it's very, very difficult to see that Turkey would in any way be keen for this. They like the rest of us, expect what the referendum result is going to be. Very difficult to see that they would have any enthusiasm for what followed and for what lessons the Kurdish population within the borders of Turkey would take from it.
And unfortunately, not difficult to imagine Turkey quite forcibly encouraging Kurds in Turkey to go and live in Iraqi Kurdistan if they want their own country.
Possibly so, but again, they would be very concerned, I think, about building this up as a sort of entity which had any greater economic or military power than it does, for what the consequences might be for the wider region. I mean, Florence very rightly points out this is something that's gone on for decades. It really comes back to, you know, the carving up of the Ottoman Empire, and the Kurds lost out then and have continued to do so in terms of statehood since.
And that is also, I think, a question. It's would the Kurds agree between themselves? Like, let's suppose there is a Kurdistan. Why would Kurdistan be limited to the north of Iraq? Because there are Kurds all over the region, a bit in Iran, a bit in Syria, as we all learned with the conflict, and a good chunk in Turkey. But they never really agreed between themselves on what a Kurdistan would be.
Well, Iraqi Kurdistan within itself managed to conduct a civil war for a while there. But
yeah, even with one of the factions asking the help of Saddam Hussein against the other.
Well, indeed, but that, of course, figures into their recent history. And when, if you look at how the West should perceive this, do the Kurds have an argument that they're owed a bit of support from the West at this point? Because not only have they recently fought, you know, with considerable courage and considerable value against Islamic State, they were also the part of Iraq that got with the program, such as it was after the invasion of Saddam Hussein. They did, you know, embrace the idea or embrace the opportunity that was offered in a way that a lot of the country didn't. They have good cause to regard themselves as having been good allies of the
certainly,
West.
Certainly, certainly. But I didn't hear them really asking for the support of the West, because they are very well aware of the potential of conflict that the creation of such a state would mean.
James, just a final thought on this. So far, one country, Israel, has suggested that it would endorse Kurdistan's independence, and it's not hard to see the connection there, that Israel sort of perceives, I think, another people seeking a home to call their own, and I think also sees perhaps the potential of an actual ally in the Middle East, which is something Israel has generally lacked. But which other countries can we imagine might be persuaded to exchange ambassadors with the independent Republic of Kurdistan?
That's an extremely difficult question, and I don't think there'll be many NATO members, for example, given how that would likely infuriate Turkey. So I think recognition, as I say, would be the biggest challenge, probably, and I can't see that any of the neighbouring countries would be keen. And I think Florence also raises a very salient point in that while Kurdistan may have been a sort of ideological dream for all Kurdish people for many decades, the actual idea of how these disparate Kurdish populations might come together to, in practice, to create a state is a really huge question.
I mean, is it possible, do you think, Florence, that the Kurds could be talked down from statehood? Are there concessions that the Baghdad government could make?
Maybe that's why they are calling this referendum. I mean, it's kind of a balance of power with the Iraqi government. I would say this is very obviously one of their goals. Whether they will go really till the referendum and then to apply the result of the referendum is another question. But definitely, in any case, this will have a lot of weight on the Baghdad government. And that was also the game, again, under Saddam Hussein. I mean, it was a constant game, not game, it's a bit cynical to say that, but with the Kurds trying to impose the fact that they would be autonomous, they would have their own territory, and that's the same game going on and on. The central government in Baghdad facing the Kurds that want to leave the country.
Okay, well, finally tonight, some confirmation, as if it were needed, that the EU will still find ways to squabble amongst itself once the UK finally leaves. Jean-Claude Juncker, the Grand Panjandrum of the European Commission, has given his annual State of the Union speech, in which he envisaged an enlarging of the Eurozone and of the borderless Schengen area. He had barely gotten off the stage before Austria, for one, expressed its unenthusiasm for the prospect. Florence, first of all, are we seeing in... I mean, Jean-Claude Juncker is obviously a fairly hardcore ideological Eurocrat, but are him and others of his ilk feeling kind of liberated by the idea that the UK is leaving? Because it is the UK that for so long has been this bastion of resistance to ever closer union, as Juncker and others of his ilk enjoy talking of it.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, he wants to make the best of it, of course, but no European is happy to see the UK leaving. So what you do after that, like you have to try to give a new impulse. You have to say, oh, it's okay, we will still go forward, because there was this idea in the Brexit camp that, okay, if we leave, that will be the end of Europe. And that was a fear of the EU. So now they realize that the union is okay even after this departure. You have, of course, like probably to make UK understand that the fact they are leaving is not a good idea and they will have to pay for it. And then what you have to do, of course, is to try to make the club go forward, to give new impulse, new ideas. So this is not really new ideas, let's say, but the extension of the euro, it's not a revolutionary idea. But of course, if Juncker has to propose something new, let's say, I mean, something that could be a kind of a goal, yes, why not this? But definitely it's not because he's happy that... I don't think it will be, as you said, Austria already has said it was against the idea, so it won't be that without the UK everything will be fine and nice and everybody will agree. We see already this divide between Eastern and Western Europe, so The problems are not solved.
Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, for the moment at least, James, has announced that she intends to give a major speech in Florence on September 22nd. Do we have the least idea of what she might possibly say and why she's picking Florence?
No, well,
I mean there is, of course, the backdrop of the sort of once great banking centre sort of reduced to irrelevance by a series of poor political decisions, but I'm sure... I'm sure that's not what she was thinking of.
I was discussing this with a correspondent from another EU country just yesterday, actually, why Florence, actually, and we came up with the conclusion...
It's a nice town.
Not a great insight, but just the Florence speech would sound rather good, you know, just of like Margaret Thatcher's Bruges speech. But content-wise, and there was maybe a sort of, a conscious choice to choose something that would sound good in the future. Content-wise, I think it's very difficult to see what she can say. I mean, you know, I think probably the Lancaster House speech, which she gave earlier this year, at the beginning of this year, the real Brexit means Brexit hardline speech, is probably sums up more what her government has got in mind, and indeed the kind of line it's continuing to pursue. So I think, you know, Theresa May will presumably, I mean, politicians always very cannily try to adjust their message to suit their audience. This will be perhaps more conciliatory than if it were made to a group of backbench Tory MPs. But I think, you know, the Brexit means Brexit, and whatever Brexit form Brexit eventually takes, and the fact that the UK has decided to leave is something that people can't get beyond, and it's very difficult to see what she can say which is suddenly going to, you know, change history and make everything all right.
I mean, Florence, do you think that the UK still is underestimating the degree of annoyance, resentment and upset that there is from the rest of the EU? Because the UK was always the awkward member of the union, and as a result, you know, concessions were made to keep it happy, and nevertheless, the UK has turned on its heel and walked.
OK, it's not the only country for which there was concession. Like on Common Agricultural Policy, for example, there were some concessions to France. No, I don't feel any resentment. I don't feel any desire of vengeance. Again, there is just this avowed will by the EU to to show that if you leave the EU, I mean, you leave, you give up advantages. That's it. Which is an idea that was not very, very clear to the UK. It's a fact.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of today's show. James Rogers and Florence Biedermann, thanks both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sophia Amadi. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist, and there's more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.